And for the rest of you, you can open up to 1 Samuel chapter 25. We're just continuing on in this story of the life of David. We're going to really just focus on 1 Samuel. So we only have this week and next week. If you can believe it or not, we're going to enter into our Palm Sunday and Easter kind of messages. And so we're only 4 weeks-ish away from Easter, if you can believe it, maybe not even that. My math, you didn't hire me for my math abilities, and so it could be sooner than that, all right? But if you can believe it or not, we're there. So we just have 2 more weeks in this, and then after Easter, we're going to do a little 5 to 6 week sermon series through the parables of Jesus, all right? And so that's what we're kind of looking at, looking forward. But I want to take you back a little bit to the a little bit in American history. The date is April 27th, 1777. The place is Ridgefield, Connecticut. And this is kind of a spot where the American Revolutionary War was kind of taking effect. And this was a huge battle. One of George Washington's famous and most reliable generals was basically outmanned, outgunned by the British. And things were not looking good at this battle. So basically, this general ordered his men to retreat, and they did that. But this general actually stayed on the line and fought against the British troops to hold them off so that his men could then go and find safety and retreat and not be harmed. Well, in the kind of the middle of him fighting off the British, his horse was shot out from under him, and basically the horse fell on top of him and he was pinned. And so in that moment, he still was fighting off British soldiers. And when they were literally arm's length away from him, he was still fighting them off, and he was able to actually get away from them and live through the experience and get to his men and to safety with them. Well, this was one of just the many of the heroic feats that this general did with his men and that his men saw him pull off. The man was Benedict Arnold. He was one of the youngest generals and arguably one of the most capable military minds that our nation has ever seen. But unfortunately, he also had a fragile ego. The Continental Congress, for whatever reason, overlooked him for many promotions. They never really recognized his military genius and all of his things. And he got overlooked for promotion after promotion after promotion. To make matters worse, Congress even refused to raise his salary, even by a little bit, even though he clearly deserved it. Well, if you fast forward kind of a few months, Benedict Arnold was one of the commanders for General Horatio Gates, a man whose skill really didn't hold a candle to Benedict Arnold. Benedict Arnold was a greater mastermind and military mind than Gates ever was. Well, the men at Saratoga loved and actually preferred Arnold more so than they liked Gates. Well, General Gates refused to kind of heed Arnold's counsel in it, and basically he told Arnold to go to his tent and just stay there. Well, he didn't heed Arnold's advice, so in the battle, the men were getting just ambushed from all sides, and the Americans were getting beat left and right. Well, Arnold heard about it, and he escaped from his tent, went in there, and led a counterattack to the side, and actually was the reason the Americans were actually able to win at the Battle of Saratoga. Well, after it, you would think like Americans and General Gates would be just thankful for Benedict Arnold. Well, not exactly. Even though Benedict Arnold was the reason they won the war, they actually gave all the praise to General Gates. Well, fast forward a few years, and Benedict Arnold is now in Philadelphia. Well, his wife Peggy began to get all these articles from Britain, and she started to show him all the articles from what the British kind of were saying about the war and stuff like that. And he saw that the British held him a lot in higher regard than the Americans ever did. And so what happened is that his wife arranged a meeting with Arnold and all the British officers. And just like that, an American hero, an American patriot, is now known for his treason, for being a traitor. A man who actually did so much for his country in just one act was just now seen as a traitor for his country. And in today's story in 1 Samuel 25, you're going to see David come close to doing just that. He's going to almost and basically sell out his values he's championed up to this point just in a matter of a moment. Think of kind of 1 Samuel 25 as part two to kind of last week's sermon in chapter 24. David was a hero then. He bravely defied kind of taking matters into his own hands and said, no, it is not right for me to kill Saul because that would be murder. And basically he went to Saul. It's like, listen, there's no one who's going to love you more and be more obedient to you, Saul, than me. So why are you coming after me? And you see David in this response, this beautiful gospel picture of what it means to trust God with your life and just leave the results up to God. Well, in this chapter, David is the one whose faith actually falters in this, where we see his men were the ones like, hey, yeah, go kill Saul. He's right there for the taking. And David's like, no, I can't do that. That's not right. It's actually David whose faith who falters in this one and who's the one where his flesh gets the best of him. And somebody else has to actually come in and rescue him from the things that he's about to do. And while one level it's kind of understandable why he's so angry, it's going to leave us wondering, is David really the king that we've been looking for? Is he really the king that's being promised here? And so let's start reading in verse 1 and kind of see in chapter 25 and just see what's going on in this chapter. It says in verse 1, now Samuel died and all of Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him at his home in Ramah. And then David moved down into the desert of Paran. Now this is important, I think, because Samuel always functioned as somewhat of a father figure to David, a spiritual mentor, and the one who believed in David when nobody else really did. And now he's gone. And so you're going to see that David kind of feels shaken by that. He feels different from that. And so I think this is an important thing. Once his spiritual mentor died, you start to see a shift in David's life. Look at verse 2. A certain man in Maon who had property there at Carmel was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep, which he was shearing in Carmel. Now, simply owning land in that day would have made you wealthy. If you had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats to go with it, it would have put you into the upper 0.1% of wealth in your day. It would be like someone saying today, I have a fleet of Lamborghinis and I got a couple of homes in Turks and Caicos and stuff like that. Like, that would be the equivalent of the wealth that this guy would have accrued back in those days. Look in verse 3. His name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was an intelligent and beautiful woman, but her husband was surly and mean in his dealings. He was a Calebite. Now let me summarize kind of what's going to go on in the next few verses. David and his men had kind of been staying in the vicinity of where Abigail and Nabal lived. And so basically there were a number of times where David and his men protected their land and their crops and everything from kind of a Philistine attack. So David actually says, the Bible actually says that David was kind of a shield of protection for him and his family over the years. And so they've been sacrificially helping Nabal and his family and helped them thrive throughout the years. And so, well, in those days, it was kind of customary once a year at the time of kind of sheep shearing that when if someone had been doing that for you, that you would take a portion of all the kind of the sheep, the fur and stuff, and give it as a gift to like the people who had been doing that for you. So it was basically assumed from David that he was going to get some of the crop and the assets from Nabal because he was doing this. Well, so David sent some of his young men, it's like, hey, go back and kind of get all that stuff that they're probably going to be giving us because we have protected them from the Philistines and all that stuff. Well, to make matters worse, Nabal rejected them. And basically, he gave a stinging insult to David. Look at verse 10 and see what he says. He says, who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Who is David? Like, this dude knew who David was. He knew David. He knew the story of Goliath, probably. Like, word had spread. Like, he knew exactly who he was. Not only does this show no gratitude, he takes a shot at David. David's just another runaway slave in his mind. Imagine kind of you're a waiter at a really nice restaurant, and you and your friend are waiting tables for this huge party, and you're bending over backwards to make sure that they're taken care of, that they have everything that you need. And these people stayed for like 6-7 hours, and you were just working as hard as you could for all that time, making sure that they were taken care of. And then only at the end, they start to nitpick everything that you did and not leave a tip at all. Like, how would you feel if that happened to you? And so, and basically, at the end, not only did they not leave a tip and be like, you know, they'd be like, listen, quit begging me for money. You know, the only reason you're a waiter is probably you flunked out of school. Like, who are you to talk to me? Like, I'm the wealthy man here type of thing. Like, that's similar to what's happening for David here, except it's just basically like heightened a little bit in this situation. That is basically what happened to David here. Plus, Nabal's insult, I think, touched a nerve on David. David had grown up as the runt of the family. He was kind of this no name. I mean, when Samuel came to anoint the next king, his dad even forgot about him. He was like, oh yeah, I got this dude out in the field. Like, I had totally forgot about him. So David, his whole life has been the runt. He's been the forgotten one. He's always been the one that's had to flee for his life. So David felt a lot overlooked in his life. So this insult probably plays on the insecurities of David, all right? So David tells his men, basically, hey, that's it, guys. Grab your sword. We're going to go and take this dude out if he's going to say this to me. Nobody can disrespect me, you know? So look at verse 21, and here's what he tells his men. It's been useless, all my watching over this fellow's property in the wilderness so that nothing of his was missing. He paid me back evil for good. May God deal with David ever be so severely if by morning I leave one male of all who belong to him. So David's like, we're going to take them all out. You don't talk to me that way. You know, and basically he's saying, I'm seeking vengeance. I'm going to take out this nobody. And so the question is, where's the guy from 1 Samuel 24? You know, where is that guy? Where's the guy that's like, I'm not taking vengeance in my own hand. When he had the opportunity to kill Saul, who he would have had a lot more reason to kill Saul than he did Nabal, right? But for some reason, what happened to that guy? Last week's David resisted killing Saul. He was actively seeking to protect Saul. And this week, he's about to murder a bunch of no-name guys because he got stiffed on a tip and insulted. You know, the guy who resisted killing his enemy is about to murder a household of nobodies. You know, he passed the big test, but now he's failing in a small test. Does that ever happen to you? Do you resist a big test in your life? It's like, whoo, I got through that one, Lord. You got me through this one. Then a day later, there's this little test, there's this little sin, and you end up falling into that one. Like, what happens from that day, from one day to the next? How can you pass a big test on one day and then fail a little one on the next? After some spiritual victory that you had, maybe you fell prey to the smallest temptation. Listen, David seems worn out here, and this guy is playing on his deepest insecurities, and so David loses it. Well, Nabal and his wife named Abigail, who you remember, verse 3, it says she was discerning and a beautiful lady. Well, she hears about this. She hears, oh, David's coming, and he ain't happy. So then Abigail makes a kind of this basket for David. So she probably puts fruit, meat kebabs, a few Fig Newtons, some Starbucks gift cards, some AirPods. Like, she does everything that she can. It's like, okay, I need to schmooze this dude and kind of cover him with kindness to see what he can do. So she hurries out to go meet David. And as she approaches David, she bows down to him. And here's what she says in verse 24. She says, pardon your servant, my Lord, and let me speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. Please pay no attention, my Lord, to that wicked man Nabal. He is just like his name. His name means fool, and folly goes with him. As for me, your servant, I did not see the men my Lord sent. So Nabal's name in Hebrew actually means fool. Now, I've heard of some bad names before, like of some parents naming some kids full is about as bad as you can get. So I don't know if his name actually meant something else in a different language, and that's why it meant. I can't imagine a parent actually naming their kid Fool, but you never know. Weirder things have happened, all right? But basically, Abigail is saying here, listen, his name means stupid, and he is stupid. Like she's just calling him out for what he is. It's like, she's like, listen, I get it. He is all that you say that he is. Like, he is that man right now. Now, ladies, let me say something here. This is not the model for how you should talk about your husband to somebody else behind your back. But when there is a king or a king on his way to kill all your men in your family, you got to do what you got to do sometimes to protect them. All right. Now listen to what she says in verse 29. Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my Lord will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. So what is she doing here? She is reminding actually David of the promises of God. Who is the Lord and what has he promised to do for you, David? Did you notice how she brought up the word sling in her statement? What is she referring back to? David and Goliath, right? She's referring to the massive victories. Like, you slayed this giant. Who is my little husband right here for you to take out type of thing? Hey, remember how God took you out to Goliath for you and God fights your battles for you, David? You don't have to take matters into your own hand, David. You can just let the Lord deal with my husband as he pleases, because remember, he's done that for you in years past, so you don't have to do that now, David, to my husband. Look at verse 30. When the Lord has fulfilled my Lord every good thing he promised concerning him and has appointed him ruler over Israel, my Lord will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. And when the Lord your God has brought my Lord success, remember your servant. So one day she says, listen, one day, David, you're going to come to be king. You're going to come to the throne. And when you come to that throne, do you really want to have to tell this story of how you killed a nobody for no good reason, really? And on that day, do you want to have to tell your grandkids and grandkids about how you murdered some dude for just because he insulted you, he tested your manhood type of thing? You know, God puts you on the throne. Do you want to mention a chapter like this in your life? By the way, could I pause here? That's actually great counsel. One day, your life's going to be told to the next generation. Are you living in a way now that you're going to be proud of how it's told then? Are you living in a way now that you're going to be ashamed of the stories that's going to be passed down to your grandkids? Faith means living today in a way that one day you'll be glad you did by the stories that's told about you. It means thinking about how you want your story to be told in this generation and how you want it passed down to the next, and living that way now. Look at verse 32. David said to Abigail, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands." And so we're going to kind of stop there at the story. We're going to pick up in a little bit about the rest of the story and kind of look at what's going on. But I want to make a few points here before we go any further in the story. First, I think it shows us that we need the body of Christ. Everybody has lapses of judgment at some point in your life, at some point in your Christian walk. David in the previous chapter is the one urging for everyone to stand firm. Now, in this one, he's caving into temptation, and he needed someone to step into his life and to tell him, like, whoa, buddy, you're going off the rails here. You need to take a step back and reevaluate what you're about to do. That is why we all need Abigails in our life. Even if you think you're a David, you still need an Abigail. In verse 32, David recognizes that God sent her. And God sent you to warn him, and to warn me, and to keep me from danger. David realizes that. Listen, you have to be in a place where God sends those people to you, because everybody will have a lapse of judgment at some point in your life. You're not going to think rightly about every situation that you go through in life. Everybody gets caught in a weak moment in the right combination of factors, and you're vulnerable in that moment. Abigail is that friend who speaks up when they see you about to make a really stupid mistake. And so sometimes how God answers your prayer for wisdom is in a multitude of counselors to give you that wisdom, to speak truth into your life. And when people make one of those bad decisions, it usually happens on the throes of an emotional situation to where you're acting in emotion and not in faith. You got angry or you got excited about the possibility of something. You know, you got starry-eyed at a new possession that you could potentially have. And you need someone wise in your life who's detached from that emotional response to be able to speak truth into your life to help you figure out what's going on. Listen, an isolated person seeks his or her own desire, rages against sound judgment. Listen, you need someone who can speak into your life and speak truth into your life when you're emotional and not really thinking clearly. Listen, you need the Abigails in your life. You should pray to be an Abigail to somebody else. Abigail is really a model of godly counsel in every way. She speaks calmly. She speaks clearly. She's emotionally detached from the situation. Even with so much on the line for her, she's really just cool as a kosher cucumber here, you know? And so she doesn't freak out. Now, that's a good point. I'm about to make two more points. I have one for the ladies and one for the men, all right? So this one's for the ladies, all right? So ladies, you can be a wise woman and a blessing to your family, even with a foolish husband, okay? Sometimes women end up in bad marriages. It just happens at times. It's not an ideal situation. Maybe you got married really young, or maybe before you were even a Christian, and maybe the guy hasn't changed with you through time, and you're just kind of stuck in a marriage to where, honestly, he's a little bit of a Nabal. Like, he's just kind of a foolish guy. And so we can learn a lot from Abigail in this story. Abigail actually saves the life of her husband and her children despite her bad marriage. Some of you are in a difficult marriage, and I'm not trying to sugarcoat it. You are in a difficult marriage, and it's hard, but God has you there for a reason, even though it is hard. God has you there because you can probably see how God used that difficult marriage to teach you something about him, right? You can say, well, God has strengthened me through it, and that's probably something that you can say about it. Sometimes the best insights about God come through pain and difficulty in your life. And God is using this marriage to produce a beauty that is within you. And that is important too, just as he did with Abigail. God has you there to save the lives of others and your family. So my point is, who knows what God will do with your faithfulness in your marriage? Don't abandon your post. Learn from Abigail. Even if you're married to a fool, God can still use you to be a tool. Hey, I made that up myself. It rhymed, right? You know, I thought that was pretty good, right? All right. So that was my point for the ladies, right? All right. Now, men, don't be a Nabal. Okay? What a terrible story to be told about your life. Don't make your wife have to go behind your back to accomplish things to get your kids in church, to honor God with your finances, because you are living a foolish life. Let me show you how this story ends. Look in verse 36, okay? Let me show you how it ends. And Abigail, she returns home to come to Nabal. And behold, he was holding a feast in his house like a feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him. And he became as a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. How tragic of a life is that? But the author is trying to show us, like Abigail said, that God will fight David's battle for him if David will just leave things in God's hands. Men, it's easy just to follow the road like that you've been on the whole time and just allow somebody else to do it. don't be a Nabal in your life. Actually fight for your family. Do things according to God's will. Don't let the things that Nabal did to happen in your life as well. Be active in your family's life. Get them in church. Do what needs to be done. Which leads me to our fourth lesson. You cannot accomplish the promise of the Spirit in the power of the flesh. Now, this was a theme that we hit on last week that I want to kind of go deeper in this week. Only that in this chapter, David basically almost goes back on the lesson that he demonstrated so beautifully in the last chapter. Last week we talked about when life takes an unexpected turn, we can either take matters into our own hands or we can allow God to handle it in His way and in His timing to fulfill His promises. Whenever we try to fix something on our own time and in the power of the flesh, you know, we think by repaying unkindness with unkindness, we can fix things. Because hopefully when the other person we think, when they see how they've treated us by the way that we're treating them, that they'll see, oh, that's the way I'm acting too. So we think that they'll change from if they are unkind to us, we can be unkind back to them. And we think that that's going to change the situation. The question is, does that ever really happen? Has someone ever been unkind to you and you've been unkind to them and they'd be like, oh, I see my fault now? I'm just going to be honest with you. That's never, ever happened to me in my life. Whenever someone has been unkind to me and I've been unkind back to them, do you know what they do in return to me? Or more unkind to me, and do you know what I do back to them? I'm more unkind to them. It snowballs. I have never once to where unkindness has produced kindness. All right? And in our minds, we think, oh, well, we can just kind of do this back and forth. And fortunately, one time maybe that they'll come around. It's just never, ever happened. The problem is that never works. And listen how James puts it in the New Testament. For the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Therefore, put away all filthiness and rampant wickedness and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls. It feels like when you see a lack of righteousness in your spouse or kids or boss or friends, that if you get angry with them and punish them for what they did to you, that it's going to wake them up into righteousness. But James clearly says here, the wrath of man will not produce righteousness in others. So something else he does, he says, the implanted word sown in grace produces righteousness. So put away all wickedness and respond instead with meekness and forgiveness and with grace. That's how God's righteousness is actually produced in the world. So when someone responds to you in unkindness, we respond with righteousness because only in that sense can righteousness grow in the world today. Think about it. That's how Jesus changed us, right? Jesus didn't change us by paying us back what we owed, right? He changed us by sowing grace in us. God's law told me that what I was supposed to do, and His threats of my judgment may have scared me to maybe some outward conformity, but it didn't change me on the inside. But only His grace gave me the desire to actually obey Him. Only grace changed me. Listen, you'll never accomplish the work of the Spirit by the power of the flesh. Which leads us to our last point. Is David the king that we're actually looking for here? In some ways, I wish this story ended with David relenting on his desire to take vengeance on Nabal, but it actually doesn't happen. The author actually tucks a subtle little detail and kind of pretends or things much worse come. Look in verse 41 and 42. It says, then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as a wife. And Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her five young women attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. Well, at first glance, you're like, oh, that's great. You know, Abigail has a good husband now. She's an amazing woman. You know, she's a great catch for sure, you know. But do you see the next verse, 43? David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and both of them became his wives. So that's now wives two and three. David unfortunately begins to follow the custom of his day to exploit his position as king to take a lot of wives, which Deuteronomy 17 actually explicitly warns the future kings not to do. This chapter is one of the first indications that David is not really the king that we were hoping that he would be. You see, up to this point, he kind of seemed like he was, right? David was humble shepherd boy who trusted God in the pasture, who trusted God when he faced Goliath to defeat Goliath for him. He was the guy who didn't take vengeance into his own hands, but let God deal with Saul in his timing and his purposes. He trusted God, and he even in the most impossible circumstances, he trusted God. But here we see in this chapter, kind of this first lapse in faith where David succumbs to a vengeful spirit. And second, he starts to leverage his kingly privilege to multiply wives in direct disobedience to a command of God. We're just a few chapters into David's story, and he's already having a heart change, and we're beginning to yearn for a king much greater than David, because we're seeing he's starting to fail at what we want him to be. Listen, the point is that our salvation will never come from man, no matter how strong or righteous they may appear. In fact, in this story, the closest picture to Jesus that we get in the story, I think, is actually Abigail. She's wise, discerning, who rides in on a donkey. She humbles herself and then takes the blame for what all happened for her husband on herself, even though she's actually very innocent. She offers a meal of peace, which happens to be, by the way, a meal of lamb, and by her bravery and sacrifice purchases salvation for many in her family. Listen, David is not the best picture of Jesus in this story. It's actually Abigail. Because we're starting to see that David is actually not the king that we hope for. There has to be somebody else. And those things will actually happen later in a king, a descendant of David, who will lay down his life for those who have committed treason against God. And by the way, if you're looking for us in the story, we're Nabal. We're strutting around like kings, ungrateful for God's kindness, despising and kind of rebuffing his goodness. And Jesus, the true king, refused to take vengeance on us, dying for us instead. Listen, the true king, the king we're searching for, is not David. It will be the son of David, but not just the son of David. He is also the son of God. And unlike David, he will never falter or fail or have to be reminded to trust God. He'll be the hope, not just for Israel, but for all the nations, for us as well. And whether you know it or not, he is actually the king that we're searching for. And it's not David. So similar to last week, the question is, where are you trying to accomplish God's purposes in the flesh? Listen, like I said last week, you cannot achieve the purposes of God by disobeying the commands of God. Where are you about to become your own Benedict Arnold? To where you're just going to sell it in and become a traitor to God because you're just chasing your own glory, your own fame? Where do you need to rest and to trust God? Where do you need to let God grant vengeance on his own and you not take it? Have you submitted to King Jesus? Have you given your life to him? That's the big point. He's the true king. He's the one that God gave us. He is who you have been looking for your whole life, who gives you grace instead of judgment if you just surrender to him and receive his grace. So have you done that today? Or are you still trying to take things into your own hands? Let's pray. Father, thank you for your grace. And Father, thank you for shining light in the dark places of our hearts, Father. Lord, help us to see where we're not trusting you. Where, Father, that we may have had a victory over here, but Father, there's these little things over here that are just presenting a huge obstacle for us, Father. Lord, help us into every area in our life trust you. And Father, help us into every area of our life not take matters into our own hands. Father, help us to see that Jesus is the true king that we need, that he fulfilled everything in him that we couldn't do on our own, Father. And Lord, help us that if there's someone here who has not accepted Christ as Lord and Savior, that today that they do that. So, Father, we ask these things in your name. Amen.